washing your hands is a simple process that usually doesn't involve a lot of thought. But Minnesota has banned a key ingredient used in a lot of liquid soaps.
They actually have no measurable benefit in terms of killing germs. And the reason for that is that folks who use it in their households actually don't use the product long enough to get the antimicrobial benefit.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, why the FDA is investigating soap. President Obama is going to take some action on immigration reform with or without Congress's help, and Valley families are helping unaccompanied minors. ASU's Michael Crow and the other Pac-12 presidents are on the verge of increasing their influence in big-time college sports.
It gives more power to the 65 presidents from the major conferences at Notre Dame. They now are kind of directing their own show.
And house hunting with millennials. All of that on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ along with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic at this hour, an accident 101 northbound in Scottsdale at Princess Boulevard that's still blocking the exit ramp. That's been the case for a while this afternoon. Elsewhere, a disabled vehicle blocks the shoulder, I-10 eastbound at I-17. We're expecting mostly clear skies tonight around the valley, though there is a slight chance for rain. Look for lows to be around 80. It's currently mostly sunny and 99 degrees. In KJZZ News, wildfire managers say unmanned drones flying over wildfires could lead to firefighter injuries and force retardant bombers to be called off. The National Interagency Fire Center in Boise says so far this year at least three drones have flown within or near restricted airspace intended for wildfire fighting aircraft. The center today said a drone could lead fire managers to suspend firefighting efforts until it has left and managers are confident it won't return. A Phoenix police officer is on administrative leave after fatally shooting a woman in the West Valley on Thursday. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, an internal and criminal investigation are now underway.
The incident began when three officers went to Michelle Cousseau's apartment to serve an emergency mental health order. Phoenix PD's Tommy Thompson says the order was issued because Cousseau had threatened to shoot several mental health workers who recently provided her care. Thompson said when approached by law enforcement, she refused to come out of her apartment.
A sergeant arrived on the scene, and the officers were able to get the security door open. But as they did, Cousseau quickly opened the front door with a claw hammer raised above her head, and she came towards the officers.
Thompson says Cousseau was shot once by the sergeant and later died from her injuries. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Remember all those months ago when the so-called Gang of Eight senators had a big plan? It was approved in the Senate for broad immigration reform. It didn't go anywhere in the House. And now President Obama is expected to take executive action on immigration before the end of the month. Doris Meisner, former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service and currently a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute in D.C., says the president has a number of options.
It can go from refining the current guidelines on deportation, which, I mean, that would be one place on the spectrum, and that would build on actions that have already been taken in the Department of Homeland Security during the last 3, 4, 5 years to hone in on those people that are high priority cases for removal. Those today are almost entirely people that have a criminal conviction of one kind or another. So he could sharpen those guidelines so that the deportation priorities would reach a more targeted population. But then he could also do some broader measures or put some broader measures into place. The stakeholders, immigration communities that are arguing for broad action are looking for him to do more than refine the deportation guidelines.
Regardless of what the president throws out there, is he going to get criticism from all sides?
I believe he will get criticism from all sides. I think that's probably true. The expectations among people that have been pressing so hard for this, the expectations are very high. So there's a good chance that there could be disappointment. There will be criticism from people who will worry that any kind of an action like this can hurt the chances for immigration reform down the road, so that an executive action, to the degree that it creates controversy and deepens polarization around the immigration issue, will be of concern to some who are looking down the road and trying to find ways to create common ground. So there are lots of things that people will object to.
Doris Meisner, senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The recent wave of Central American families and children coming across the border has prompted outrage from some Arizonans, while it's tugged at the heartstrings of others. Some volunteer to help migrants at bus stations or donate clothes, and a few are even opening up their homes. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports.
Judy and Bernie Armstrong are in their early 60s. They moved from Kansas a few years ago to a quiet Peoria neighborhood surrounded by desert.
We don't need a house this big. There's two of us, but we need a place where our kids come to visit and our grandkids, so it's plenty of room to house people here.
Judy and Bernie decided to put their extra space to use last year. They welcomed a teenage orphan who migrated alone from Honduras. It wasn't a formal arrangement like foster care, just something they did.
He was with us for
6 months,
and, you know, he was very respectful of us. He was just a really nice young guy, and we enjoyed having him.
This is Carlos's bedroom.
There's a four-poster bed and a flowered quilt.
It's really a little girly for Carlos, but he was okay with it.
I should say here that Carlos isn't the young man's real name. He doesn't want any media attention, so the Armstrongs are protecting his privacy.
Did you know anything about Carlos before he arrived?
We knew he was from Honduras. We knew that he had gone through the court system and he had applied for a green card, and he hadn't received it yet, but it was on its way. Other than that, we really didn't know a lot about him. It was taking a bit of a leap.
This wasn't their first time. The Armstrongs began hosting refugees from Vietnam in the early 80s. They heard about Carlos at their church. While most unaccompanied children coming from Central America are joining relatives, Carlos is an orphan who didn't have anyone here. With the help of lawyers from the nonprofit The Florence Project, Carlos won his immigration case and was about to get his green card. But he was also about to turn 18, which meant he couldn't stay at the migrant youth shelter where he'd been held.
And the option would be going to adult detention facility. Usually they're down in Florence or Eloy, if there wasn't someone who could provide the secure housing.
They picked up Carlos on his 18th birthday. Judy realized he must have been terrified.
All of a sudden, he's just being given to an English-speaking elderly American who's going to take him away from the little that was familiar.
There was a language barrier.
Between he had an English dictionary and I had a Spanish dictionary, and sometimes we just had to point.
Eventually, they learned why Carlos fled Honduras.
He was knifed. He was left on the street bleeding, assumed dead. He came to in the hospital, spent 3 months there. And when he was discharged, he no longer had a job and he no longer had a place to stay. And he was afraid. He knew it could happen again. So he and a friend decided to make their way to this country.
The couple helped Carlos navigate the bureaucracy of getting a Social Security card, a state ID, and a food handler's license. They each have their own reasons for wanting to host newcomers. When Bernie wasn't much older than Carlos, he went abroad, too, to serve in Vietnam. There he depended on the kindness of locals.
Sometimes a nightfall would come and we would be, you know, at some village someplace and with no place to stay, and people would take us in.
I know I had a grandmother, great-grandmother, who came from Ireland in steerage at the age of 17. Not that different than the young man who stayed with us.
Carlos was able to move out of the Armstrongs' home when he got off a waiting list for a housing program for young adults. He has a job now. The three still visit often.
We're friends on Facebook, and he calls me every once in a while, and he made a deal. And he said, when I call you, I'm only going to speak English.
In the coming weeks, more teenage migrants held in Phoenix-area shelters will turn 18. Those without relatives here will need a place to go. The Phoenix Restoration Project, a local nonprofit, is recruiting volunteer hosts. The Armstrongs are preparing for their next young house guest in September. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Last night at East Lake Park in Phoenix, people gathered to remember Michael Brown, the unarmed black man shot by police this week in Ferguson, Missouri. The vigil included a prayer said by community member Lawrence Robinson.
We ask that in our streets, which are ripped with gun violence, in our homes, where we cry because of all of the actions taken against us in injustice, and within all of the halls of leadership, that we unite to find a solution instead of just frustration.
We reflect now on that tragedy and the fears and tensions that have enveloped the entire St. Louis community and the lessons for America at large. The shooting of an unarmed black man by police fuels the national conversation.
Joining us now to discuss all this is Avis Jones DeWeaver, businesswoman and CEO of the social justice consulting firm Inside Unlimited, and Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whytopia and senior fellow at Demos. Welcome back, Avis and Rich.
Glad to be here, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Avis, what is this about outside of the flashpoint of police and young African-American males? Because it seems like so much is in play here in St. Louis, a divided community, a segregated community that really speaks of the economic inequalities in America that build tensions that every time something like this happens, we see a variety of issues coming out.
Exactly. This is, at the heart of it, a variety of issues. It includes a community that is completely disjointed from its political representation, from the police department that is supposed to be protecting and serving it. And in the midst of all of that, you end up with situations where those individuals who live in that community are not looked at, apparently, as citizens, as we can sort of surmise as we look at what's happened in the wake of the shooting, and instead looked at it almost as the enemy. It is not a unified community when you're looking at who exactly lives there versus who are representing those individuals and who are charged with protecting and serving them, but apparently are not doing that in a very efficient and very humane manner.
Rich Benjamin, do you see this criminalization of American citizens as a primarily racial issue, or is it something that's happening on all fronts since 9/11 and the buildup of this kind of security state and security approach to law enforcement where everybody's going through a metal detector? The presumption is that people are going to defy authority and defy the law, and that that has consequences all the way around.
John, they go hand in glove to some extent, but it's deeply a racial issue when you consider who is policed, how the law is enforced, how arrests are made. So we do see this police state as of 9/11, but at first it was often directed against Arab Americans. But now we see it against brown and black youth. We see it in the Trayvon Martin case. We see it in the way that immigrant kids are treated. We saw it when the congressional hopeful in Arizona was shouting down the kids in a YMCA bus. This racial paranoia, this mentality of treating folks as criminals, yes, it has to do with 9/11 and a security mentality, but it's not incidental to race.
Let's talk about the Trayvon Martin case in the sense that, and you referred to this, Avis, there's a political disjointedness in the sense that stand your ground laws are popular in Florida, but they send a very inflammatory message to African-American communities in Florida. How can a popular law in a state be so unpopular and so targeting of huge constituencies in Florida? It's not like there are only a few African-Americans in Florida, Avis.
Exactly, because certain communities, particularly the African-American community, understands that we are, in a knee-jerk reaction, viewed with suspicion and oftentimes viewed as violent, oftentimes viewed as criminal. Oftentimes we are the object of fear. And when you have a law that says, basically, you just have to be in fear of your safety without having any legitimate reason, frankly, to really be fearful, certain communities and specifically African Americans know that historically speaking, that means death to us. And we have seen that in Florida. We saw it with Renisha McBride. We see it here in terms of the over-aggressive nature of the police force. It is this base fear of the black body that leads to situations like we've seen with Trayvon all the way up to what happened to Michael Brown.
And we saw it in the chokehold death here in New York City. Is this the stop and frisk mentality in a social and political dimension?
It definitely is. And what's really disturbing here is there is a lack of acknowledgement of the basic humanity of individuals. I'm really struck by the difference that we see in approaches from the two types of police reactions post this tragedy. When we saw the initial police amalgamation of forces that came together to greet the protesters, and we saw all of the militarization, we saw all of the aggressiveness, we saw all the huge show of force, we saw basically marksmen trained on citizens in our country. And we saw that from a police force that was white-led and primarily white, to be honest. It was obvious that those individuals were seen as potentially violent and not really citizens. And when you juxtapose that against an approach that we see now, which is more welcoming, which is more, I am one of you, you are part of me, I want to hear your stories, I want to march with you, I too want justice. It's night and day, the reaction.
Avis is referring to the change in tone there in Ferguson when Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri State Highway Patrol really took the responsibility for law enforcement and keeping the peace there in Ferguson. Where does this go? I mean, we could be talking about St. Louis today. We could be talking about Newark tomorrow. We could be talking about Oakland the next day, Seattle.
Right.
I mean, they're having demonstrations in Seattle, Houston.
Right.
So what do we do about this? This seems to be on an inexorable course.
You know, to me, the real answer to this is accountability. And when you have a history of police who have used very aggressive tactics leading to death in a number of situations, and you rarely see people going to jail because of those actions, that is really the root of the distrust between the community and the police departments. And until we see real accountability on a massive scale that puts the message out there that if you take somebody's life away from them in a callous and irresponsible way, you will go to jail. Whether or not you are a policeman, we will never see the broad scale change that we need to see to make people like me and people like my sons feel safe in their communities.
Rich Benjamin.
Final thoughts on this end is I was just mortified and horrified by that hashtag the young folks put up, if I were gunned down. What kind of country do we share when young folks have that kind of ironic, horrified hashtag? So bottom line, I hope we learn something from this in the way that we didn't really learn anything from Trayvon. Nothing materially changed in terms of our laws. Nothing materially changed in terms of our policing. So I hope a year later we have a different scenario where we are looking at very different issues and that we truly, i.e. elected leaders, learn something.
Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitetopia, a senior fellow at Demos, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Avis Jones DeWeaver is the CEO of the social justice consulting firm Insight Unlimited. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. There are only a few hours left for you to request an early ballot for Arizona's August 26th primary election. And as Maricopa County Elections Director Karen Osborne explains, there are multiple language options.
The printed ballot is in two languages, English and Spanish, but we also do Tohono O'odham. That is a non-printed language, and it is done by touchscreen if you come into one of our facilities to vote.
Is there a particular threshold for a certain number of people who speak a certain language to have a language added to the ballot? How does that work, and where does the Voting Rights Act come in for that?
Well, this actually comes through if there's more than 5% of the citizen voting age, according to the census, in a particular language, then that's how it becomes something we need to pay attention to and add to the ballot preparation. We used to have three Native American languages, and now we only have the one Tohono O'odham that we do our translation in. None of our Arizona languages, Native languages, are printed. So it gives us some extra challenges to try and get that out there to work with everybody. But the Spanish and English are both on the same ballot.
Are there other languages that are on ballots in other Arizona counties? Or as you mentioned, the three Native American now down to one. Does that apply statewide?
Well, no. In the other counties, we have Apache, Navajo, Pueblo, Havasupai, Hopi, Zuni, Tohono O'odham, Pima and Yavapai, Yaqui, and Yuman. Those are all different tribal languages, and it depends by the census where that applies to each individual county.
And Karen, last thing for you, is there, even if you could talk more about the previous election, but I'm curious, when people actually request the ballots, I mean, certainly not 100% of them turn them in, but is it an extremely high percentage that turn them back in?
Well, it seems as though if in the years when you have had to ask for a ballot before we went to the permanent early voting, the return rate was higher because it seemed as though they were invested. They'd had to make the effort to ask. Last primary election, if memory serves me correct, we had over 85% of the people who voted by mail.
Maricopa County Elections Director Karen Osborne. As of earlier this week, more than 921,000 early ballots have been requested in Maricopa County. Coming up, what are millennials looking for when they're trying to find a place to live?
I think a very heavily underserved segment of the marketplace right now is a demographic that is looking for clean, safe, and affordable housing. And affordable doesn't mean low income.
Hunting, house hunting, that is, with millennials. It's the show. No big problems in Valley traffic this afternoon. We just have one in, though, I-17 southbound at 16th Street. That collision is blocking the off-ramp. And if you're on the 87 north, watch out for a collision at Fort McDowell Road. Very slight chance for rain tonight around the valley, otherwise mostly clear skies and temperatures around 80. And then for this weekend, mostly sunny both Saturday and Sunday with highs of 106. It's currently mostly sunny and 100 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Solar Tops, an Arizona-based SunPower Elite dealer offering homeowners options to make the switch to clean, renewable energy and help reduce their electricity use. 480-940-1201.
Recently, a map put together by the Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies showed which religious traditions have the second highest number of followers in each state. What surprised a lot of people is that Hinduism took the second spot in Arizona. U of A religion professor Caleb Simmons says the increasing number of Hindu followers in the state will be reflected in the culture, especially in larger cities.
Overall, it's starting to not only be represented within the culture, but it's starting to shape it more broadly. Terms like dharma and karma are now have they're part of the American vocabulary. And I think it also adapts the Hindu tradition. And so as Hindu Americans who are born here, they also incorporate those American values back into the tradition.
To learn more about Hinduism and its traditions, I visited the Ekta Mandir Hindu Temple in West Phoenix. When I got there, I was greeted by Uma Raman, a 20-year-old woman who has been volunteering at the temple and in the community for some time. Once I took off my shoes and she showed me through the front door, I immediately noticed the strong smell of incense and the sound of prayers being chanted. The temple is gorgeous and opulent. The floors appear to be made of smooth, light-colored stone. Beyond the entranceway is a large open room with chairs in the back and a raised section starting in the middle. That's where there were two priests leading rituals or puja. Sitting on rugs around them were a few dozen devotees who are getting ready to make a pilgrimage to a Hindu holy site in Tibet, Mount Kailash. Nearby was a plate of ritual offerings, including bananas and rose petals. And just beyond where the rituals were taking place were a number of shrines that featured different deities, which are statues of the Hindu incarnation of God in different forms. Uma and five other community members who worship at the Ekta Mandir Temple and are part of the Indo-American Cultural and Religious Foundation met with me in a room just behind this area and talked with me about what Hinduism is to them. Uma's younger brother, Kailash Raman, explained that a common misconception of Hinduism is that there is more than one God.
The ultimate core belief of Hinduism is that there is one ultimate, supreme, formless God, and this God pervades throughout the entire universe and is in every living being, on all matter, and to represent this formless, abstract God, we worship these several different forms of this God in as different deities that you see in the temple.
Hinduism is not really any religion. It is the name that is there for Hinduism is dharma. Okay, dharma means duty. And the duty of any human being, that's what the principles of Hinduism give.
That's Amrish Bhargava. And the concept of dharma, or duty, came up a lot in our group conversation. Uma Raman says that more than anything, dharma is for personal benefit, in order to reach God.
I think dharma is not set up in the sense of there being an external good or external bad or external reward. Dharma is the idea that if the goal is to reach God, the goal is to become one with God. And so the idea is that if you don't perform dharma, you're moving away from God, and then you are the one who suffers for it.
Again, Amrish Bhargava.
Every person, if he follows the principles of Hinduism, is a Hindu. You don't have to convert to Hinduism. It's a way of life.
Based on your karma, your actions, you know, you'll go through this life and death and this cycle, and what you want to do is break. So by continuing to do that good deeds and conducting yourself in the dharmic way, you want to attain that moksha, nirvana, to become part of God and then break this cycle.
As Mahesh Shah says, that idea of working toward enlightenment by acting in accordance with Hindu principles is central to Hinduism. But Uma Raman says that for younger generations, figuring out exactly what that means can be very individualistic.
The rebellion that is often seen in Hinduism, I guess, or rejection of Hinduism amongst our generation is that a lot of the stuff is not explained to you explicitly. We don't have someone that tells us exactly what Hinduism is. Personally, it has very much been a journey of self-exploration throughout the religion, which is a conscious effort you have to make. If you don't, you're sitting in a temple, seeing these rituals being done, and it's hard to connect to it because you haven't been brought up with everyone doing that, and you can't just take it for granted that that's how it is. So then a lot of people lose sight of it.
Vikram Shah also mentioned that even though many people go to a temple to pray, Hinduism is flexible and can be practiced anywhere.
You don't need to go to the temple. A lot of people do have a small temple in their own home where they can pray and do the same rituals at their home.
God could be in you, in me, in our parents, teachers, and in the different forms.
That's Nate Badri Raju. And I also spoke with two priests at the Ekta Mandir temple about the many different rituals they perform. This is priest Hari Joshi.
Every activity which religion, like are we giving first time food our children, we have to do worship and pray. Are we first time cutting hair, we have to do worship and pray. Like this, our every activity with religious. That's a priest is our very responsible duty.
One unique thing about the Ekta Mandir temple is that it includes people from all different parts of India and incorporates different customs that often vary regionally. In fact, the two priests I met, Hari Joshi and Sudarshan Abhat, were from different regions and chanted a mantra in the way that each of them is accustomed to. Ekta Mandir is one of around a dozen Hindu temples in the Phoenix area that collectively serve the growing number of Hindus in the valley. To see a slideshow of pictures from my visit to the Ekta Mandir temple, taken by senior producer Sarah Ventry, visit kjzz.org.
New research suggests millennials could be on the verge of having a major impact on the housing market. The report from the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies shows there are still a lot of young adults living with their parents, but it says when they do move out, there's a good chance a lot of them will rent rather than buy. Pete Tecamp is a commercial real estate agent at Marcus & Millichap in Phoenix and says the Valley's apartment rental market is improving.
A lot of people euphemistically referred to that time period in 2008 and 9 and 10 as the Great Recession, and I would call it the time that we all held on for dear life. We're building again, and we're building in a specific segment of the rental market, which gives me some concern.
What segment of the market is concerning to you in the sense that it's a lot of building in?
We're getting top heavy. Virtually all the new units, with a few exceptions, but most of the new units that are coming online right now are Class A apartments. And
luxury type apartments.
And you go to these places, they're beautiful. They look like resorts, amenity rich. I mean, just absolutely stunning. But of all the units that have been built in the last 2 years, the weighted average asking rental rate is $1,295. And the mathematically weighted average asking rental rate for all apartments valley-wide, during the same period was 787. So that's a big jump, and affordability, in my viewpoint, is an issue that is looming on the horizon.
So it sounds like these new apartments are catering to a very particular type of renter.
Yes, and I think the developers have figured out their market, their target market. It's just that sometimes we get into a situation where a market might get saturated, and I'm not saying that's where we are right now, but a lot of people might decide, or groups might decide, hey, you know what, let's get into that before that market goes away.
Do we have enough people who can afford those kinds of rents to rent all these new high-end apartments?
I hope so. And I think a very heavily underserved segment of the marketplace right now is the demographic that is looking for clean, safe, and affordable housing. And affordable doesn't mean low income.
So as the economy gets better and recovers from, as you call it, the time we all held on for dear life, and you know, some folks, especially some millennials, are able to move out of roommate situations or move out of their parents' houses, a lot of them seem to be looking to rent. And I'm curious if a $1,200 a month rent is something they're looking for, if they're looking maybe for something that's a little more affordable as they're just sort of getting themselves back on their economic feet.
Well, one of the factors to this is location. There are some new buildings that have been built in the Biltmore area around the Kalmbach corridor, and that is one of the places to be. Old Town Scottsdale, North Scottsdale. In fact, what's interesting, in the last 3 years, the majority of the units added to our rental market since and including 2011 were in North Scottsdale, South Scottsdale, North Tempe, South Tempe, Chandler, and Gilbert. And those areas have just been the hotbeds of activity. Now we're seeing areas like Central Phoenix really catch on.
At what point do you think the Phoenix area's apartment market will be full or potentially saturated and will stop building new apartments?
I hope that that never happens, but in 2010, we saw virtually no apartments added to there were a few, couple projects that were spillover, but I don't know that we'll ever be fully built out. We're always a market that's reinventing ourselves.
Pete Tecamp is a commercial real estate agent at Marcus & Millichap in Phoenix.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Nighttime. My name is Todd Johnson. I'm a highways operations worker, and we're out here preparing a crash attenuator on the 51. It's pieces of metal and cushions that we put at the end of cement barriers to cushion when somebody hits it, so it lessens the impact, so there's less damage to the car and there's less damage to the structure. Somebody had hit it, so we got to pull it all apart. Take off all the damaged pieces, replace it with new ones, and just reset it back up for the next hit. The night is just usually for stuff that's on the freeways. It's hard to get during the daytime. They have high volume traffic, so it's just safer to do at night.
That's Todd Johnson working on an on-ramp for the Loop 101. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want us to play in traffic, send us a note to the show at kjzz.org.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where teams of experts work together to focus on you. Learn which health plans include Mayo Clinic, or you can request an appointment at mayoclinic.org/Arizona.
I am an enthusiastic hand washer. I especially appreciate liquid foam soap with its bubbly lather that rinses off so easily. But the active ingredient in the foam soap I use is something called triclosan. The state of Minnesota decided to ban all products that contain triclosan as of January 1, 2017. And the Food and Drug Administration wants makers of antibacterial hand soap and body wash to offer evidence that the cleaners, including triclosan, are better at preventing illness than an average bar of soap. Angela Gonzalez has been following FDA action for the Phoenix Business Journal. She says this was not an overnight development.
The FDA for years has been promising to review it because there have been some environmental groups that have been just screaming there's something wrong with this product. But a lot of people say that the FDA drug its feet in reviewing it.
Rolf Halden, director of the Center for Environmental Security at Arizona State University, explains the broader reason behind Minnesota putting up legal barriers to triclosan-containing products.
This was triggered by work work that showed the chemicals to be present in the natural water resources of the state of the 10,000 lakes. And it also showed that there is a byproduct, dioxins, that are present in formulations of triclosan and that also occur in the environment as degradation products. And the dioxins are carcinogenic, so cancer-causing agents.
Halden is author of a paper published earlier this year in Environmental Science and Technology that questions whether soaps advertised as antibacterial or antimicrobial are actually limiting the spread of sickness or disease.
They actually have no measurable benefit in terms of killing germs. And the reason for that is that folks who use it in their households actually don't use the product long enough to get the antimicrobial benefit of the product. So if you observe that yourself at home or on the road, you probably wash your hands on average for about 6 seconds, you know, before you rinse off the soap. And that's just not long enough contact time for the chemical to be effective. And so what we end up with is an unwanted exposure to the chemicals and then a dispersal of these chemicals first into the sewer line and then later into the environment.
Halden says antimicrobial soaps can be appropriate in certain situations, though.
If you go into the operating room, you want your doctor to wash his or her hands with these antimicrobial soaps. But for the general person on the street, they really don't reap the benefits of these products.
He is ultimately more concerned about the broader consequences.
Overuse of antibiotics is one issue that fosters drug resistance, but then also consumers contribute to it by using antimicrobials that further force the development and spread of drug-resistant organisms and drug-resistance genes.
Not everyone is convinced that FDA action is necessary. Again, Angela Gonzalez of the Phoenix Business Journal.
The American Cleaning Institute is saying it's fine. They're asking the FDA to be really careful when they're reviewing this. They're saying, we've been using these products for 30 years. It's fine. So we have both sides of the fence giving their perspective.
Minnesota's ban and the FDA's investigation are expected to have a huge impact on the soap industry, or at least the labels you'll see in the hygiene products aisle, as triclosan is de-emphasized and ultimately removed. Scottsdale-based Henkel, maker of Dial soaps, sent us a statement saying the company constantly evaluates new ingredients, developing formulas and solutions to bring the best possible products to market for our consumers. We listen to their preferences and needs. Through this process, we are introducing new formulas for Dial antibacterial liquid hand soaps, removing triclosan, and replacing it with another active ingredient regulated by the FDA. These new liquid hand soap formulas will continue to meet high safety and efficacy standards and address consumer preferences and needs. As to whether Arizona will implement its own ban following in Minnesota's footsteps, Angela Gonzalez of the Business Journal told us the state health department cannot act on its own and would have to wait for legislative action, which is not pending. The NCAA, which has overseen college athletics, including its schools and student-athletes for more than a century, is gradually losing its power base. Only the most zealous opponents are predicting its imminent demise, but five of its member conferences, including the Pac-12, are asserting strong influence to make some of their own rules. John Wilner is a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and the man behind the College Hotline blog.
The five power conferences are still part of the NCAA, so the better question is, how much power does the rest of the NCAA still have? And it's dwindling, I'd say. You know, the impetus for this is that the five conferences in Notre Dame have got so much money from their TV deals that they feel like they need to provide services for the student athletes. But the other conferences don't have the money to improve, medical insurance and pay for post-career education options. And specifically, the big one is reimbursing the athletes for the full cost of attendance. You know, the scholarship check doesn't cover everything. There's a gap of a few thousand dollars between what the real expenses are and what the scholarship check covers. And the big conferences have the money to make up for that difference and feel like they should do it.
When you say that it's something they think they should do, the cynic in many of us would think it's because of trying to avoid a future lawsuit as opposed to doing out of the kindness of their hearts. But am I wrong about that?
Not totally wrong. I think that's a gray area. This whole cost of attendance movement actually started 3 or 4 years ago, and the power conferences their movement was blocked by everybody else in the NCAA. If you go back to that point, what was their motivation? Were they worried about the lawsuits? Was it just the goodness of their heart? I think maybe a little bit of both.
From the standpoint of all of these changes with the Power Five conferences and the Pac-12's role in it, does this give more power to college presidents? Does it vary from school to school, conference to conference?
It gives more power to the 65 presidents from the major conferences at Notre Dame. They now are kind of directing their own show with the freedom to change the rules, recruiting rules, you know, academic service rules. They can do what they want. And so, you know, I think that the commissioners of those conferences and the presidents of those conferences definitely have got more power because the big money is in football and they now can write their own rules essentially for football.
When we have some of these conference commissioners, are they chosen because of they have a certain background in athletics, or is it more about, okay, this is someone who can help us produce more revenue?
Well, it's interesting. There's been a little bit of a sea change. You know, it used to be that conference commissioners came up through the ranks, but that's changing a little bit. And the Pac-12 kind of was really broke the model when they hired Larry Scott, who had spent 20 years as CEO of the Women's Tennis Association. And now you're starting to see, not only at the commissioner level, but at the athletic director level, the schools are hiring people that have sports business backgrounds, hands-on experience in raising money, finding new revenue streams. ASU is a good example. You know, Steve Patterson did a great job. He had a sports business background from the professional leagues. Ray Anderson comes to ASU from the NFL.
John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News and the College Hotline blog. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight. We're only seeing a 10% chance for rain on the forecast, but a dust storm is definitely possible. We're hearing about some rain up in Payson at this hour. Looking for a high temperature tomorrow of 106. It's currently 100 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Front Doors News, your connection to Valley philanthropy, culture, luxury, and living. You can open the door to Valley society at frontdoorsnews.com.
To increase the United States' overall competitiveness, the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, are being reemphasized. Arizona is no exception. The Brewer administration has been talking about its importance as the state pushes to get a more educated workforce and attract higher-paying jobs. That push was fully on display yesterday at the Innovation Summit, which was attended by KJZZ Innovation reporter Andrew Bernier, who's here to tell us about it.
Sure. And so this was the second annual Arizona Innovation Summit. And so a little over 1,000 people attended, and it was quite a wide variety of folks that were there. You had CEOs of well-established companies such as Intel that were present, along with students from local middle schools and high schools with their robots, and everyone in between, from people working at the universities to young startups and entrepreneurs. It was quite a variety of folks who were represented there.
Does it feel like, just based on this one event, that Arizona is finding momentum that maybe it didn't have before?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in Arizona now for 6 years in the scientific community, and when I first got here, it was nearly non-existent. And so this being the second annual and the actual larger event, which is the Arizona SciTech Festival, is now entering its fourth year. And so while you might consider it still in its infancy, the rapidness of its growth and expansion is taking off. And it's really a really interesting thing to see.
I'm going to make the presumption that sometimes tech, STEM, is focused so much on the urban areas of the state, Maricopa County, Pima County in particular. But you talked with the mayor of Cottonwood. She said some interesting things, right?
Yeah, she was very insistent that there is really no difference in terms of the urban establishment of STEM versus that of rural. And so we actually have a clip from her in the interview describing her vitality of her community as why it needs to embrace STEM.
You know, if we don't train kids, whether they're urban or rural, the jobs that become available in the future that take science, technology, engineering, and math will not go to our children. So we really want to encourage them. We want to help them learn, you know, the opportunities of doing math. And, you know, our hospital is our largest employer. There are just so many opportunities right in the medical field in the small towns. But the small towns are just as important as the large ones.
Diane Jones, mayor of Cottonwood, attending yesterday's Innovation Summit. But you also talked with folks in industry, one that sounds like a really interesting project, but long-term, right?
Well, both short-term and long-term. So I had the pleasure of talking to Jane Pointer, and she's the CEO of Worldview Enterprises. And so they're a very interesting company. They are one of now, I guess I would say, emerging leaders of the privatized space exploration field. Well, almost space, top level of the stratosphere. Again, based out of Tucson, they're embracing not only STEM, but more or less the opportunities that Arizona has to offer in terms of spaceflight.
Arizona has a lot to offer, not only for Worldview, but other commercial spaceflight entities as well. One of the things we have is these enormous open spaces. Boeing, for example, is using an area in southern Arizona to land some of their spacecraft. And then we want to use areas in Arizona to launch our spacecraft, which is pretty awesome. So we're really bringing spaceflight and commercial spaceflight to Arizona.
The enthusiastic Jane Pointer, I was going to say she sounded like someone we've heard from Virgin Atlantic.
The idea of that dream and that enthusiasm, that was prolific around the conference. And so it was a really exciting atmosphere just to have these young entrepreneurs and well-established industries, just the electricity that was taking place at the conference. And so as someone who's been a part of the scientific community now and being able to report about it, it's just exciting to share that so many people were celebrating what is the innovation in this state.
Well, thanks for being with us, KJZZ Innovation Reporter Andrew Bernier, who attended the Innovation Summit. Andrew, thanks.
And thank you.
Scorpions, tarantulas, and centipedes? Oh, my. Arizona residents are not in the dark about the many creepy crawlers living in our desert, but some of our bugs live in the dark. There's a unique population of insects in our caves and caverns, and there's a lot we still have to learn about them. In Karchner Caverns, an hour outside Tucson, a new species of cave-dwelling predatory stink bug was discovered. There are over 40 different of these arthropods, centipedes, spiders, and beetles, for example, living in those caves, and you may not find those species in any other cave in the world.
These caves tend to be like little islands in a big ocean of non-caves, and those islands have their unique populations that, you know, are oftentimes millions of years old.
That's Nico Franz of the University of Arizona. He says the bugs are not native to caves, as the caves are often younger than these well-established species. Instead, groups of bugs colonize the caves, adapting and evolving to fit their environment, and are very different from their relatives living in the sun. Here's Nico Franz again.
Cave-inhabiting insects tend to be bland, even whitish. They oftentimes tend to lose their wings in the course of evolution, and the eyes are oftentimes reduced or even completely lost. Their other sensory organs are highly developed.
If the world of bugs make your skin crawl with excitement, you can learn more about our native species this weekend at Karchner Caverns. A University of Arizona entomologist will lead a lecture and scorpion walk Saturday night at 7. Think back to your first road trip through the West, whizzing through small towns in the middle of nowhere, watching bright neon signs stretch through the night before you roll back into the desert. The 7th annual Grid Show at the Trunk Space in Phoenix aims to capture that nostalgia by displaying photographs and art of those iconic and vintage Arizona signs. Historian Marshall Shore helps organize the show and choose its theme, which changes every year.
It always has to do with location. That's what the Grid Show is all about, is really this is all local art about local things.
As modern cities have expanded, more and more of the flashy signs from decades past disappear. But the signs have an important place in the history of America's Western expansion.
So these old neon signs from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s really represent Americans' love affair with the automobile and our relationship with the West and highway driving culture.
That's Damian Klinko, president of the Tucson Historic Preservation Foundation. He says that the signs were created as works of art, a collaboration between business owners and local artists, and played a big role in forming the culture of the Wild West.
Places like Vegas and Phoenix and Tucson and Los Angeles all are part of this Western story. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow. These neon signs are an integral part of that visual vocabulary. that define our built environment.
The Grid Show opens tonight from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Trunk Space in Phoenix.
Perched on the south side of Camelback Mountain is a home known as Camelback Castle. It's like no other in the area. Did you know there are many unique features about the place, including that it was built out of rocks from Camelback Mountain?
Some of the unique things, there was a 22-person jacuzzi in the living room with a skylight, a fireplace that actually had a waterfall that flowed down in front of the fireplace.
Robert Pazdurka owns the home and proudly takes me on the grounds to see the Arcadia Castle up close.
The walls are anywhere from 18 to 24 inch thick, solid stone from the mountain with concrete and rebar. Very, very much over-engineered.
The castle was built by Mort Copenhaver. He was a valley dentist. Copenhaver purchased the land the home sits on in 1967. His plan was to build a castle. Pazdurka says the doctor recruited a handful of laborers to help him build the home stone by stone, chipped away from Camelback Mountain. When it was completed, it was a nearly 8,000-square-foot multi-level home with 15 rooms, including, well, what else? A dungeon.
The property was said to be unbuildable. And at the time, he was able to negotiate, I think, a purchase price of about $4,000, strictly because it was an unbuildable lot. And he proceeded over the next 12 years to produce something that's really could never be reproduced again.
That's because the home sits several hundred feet above the valley. Pazdurka says the outer walls soar to about 50 feet high. For 20 years, he admired the fortress. So as soon as it went up for sale, he purchased it and is remodeling the home.
We are keeping the dungeon, and the intent is hopefully to enlarge it a little bit.
As we stand on the pile of construction rubble, he says the plan is to modernize it while restoring its uniqueness.
We would like to kind of continue the tradition that Mort did, and that was do tours once in a while so that the public can actually come back and see and enjoy the castle.
Airplanes landing at Sky Harbor seem to be flying past at eye level. That's because this is the highest house on Camelback Mountain. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you come up with something you think Nadine should know or the rest of the valley should know, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. There are a lot of reasons to laugh around the valley, and this weekend, some of it is actually happening on stage at the Tempe Center for the Arts.
As it turns out, the senator was texting pictures of his dinkus through Twitter to strange ladies.
Terrible!
Yes, I know, right? When I heard it, I was disgusted. In myself. I didn't know you could send pictures through Twitter.
You're awful, Doug.
You've probably heard of the Second City Comedy Troupe or the L.A.-based Groundlings. A lot of their alums have moved on to high-profile gigs with Saturday Night Live. The Valley has a sketch group of its own called Bully Mammoth, who you just heard from. Ricky Brindley, one of the founding members, says he and his partners have overcome the early bumps of not quite knowing what they were doing.
A lot of it's persistence, and your first stuff isn't necessarily always going to be good. Kind of having that knowledge in the back of your head, it makes it a little bit easier because you have a freedom to just kind of like do whatever you want with the knowledge that it like it's gonna be bad anyway. So,
so how has Bully Mammoth evolved in terms of your creative process? What goes into it? I mean, do you still have those times you throw stuff up against the wall and it's just terrible, or do you feel like you find inspiration faster these days?
There's always the risk of doing something that's quote-unquote bad. I mean, when you're playing with like irony and people's expectations, if you're sometimes you're purposely trying to be bad, and that's all that comes off, none of the irony behind it. It was just like, that didn't make any sense, man, come on. We need to work on that a little bit more.
How often do you refine stuff? Is there stuff that you really like, but you thought, oh, we did that one, we could have done it better, and then you come back and say, oh, I have a great idea for how we're going to fix it?
Yeah, totally. We've done scenes where one of us writes a character or a scene, and someone else really likes that, and we'll write like almost like a sequel to it. And so, for example, we have a little 7-year-old girl with a really bad lisp that is kind of a Nancy Drew Encyclopedia Brown type, but she also solves really like grisly Law and Order SVU style cases as well. After the first scene, someone else really liked that character and decided to write a second case for her to pick up. And so, yeah, we'll take the ball from each other and kind of pick up like that.
Ricky Brindley of the Valley-based sketch comedy troupe Bully Mammoth. They're performing tomorrow night at 8 at the Tempe Center for the Arts. As usual, a lot of stuff going on around the Valley this weekend. I don't know how you're going to find time to do all of this. On Saturday, a back-to-school Batman celebration at Samurai Comics in Central Phoenix. You can donate a backpack filled with school supplies to those in need and get a limited edition Batman 75th anniversary cape. Who of us would not look good in that? I can think Mark Brody certainly would. Let's see. Rascal Flatts with Cheryl Crown and Gloriana. That's tonight at 7:30 at Ok Chin Pavilion as part of Rascal Flatts' Rewind Tour. And if you're an Elvis fan, go to the Musical Instrument Museum and celebrate the King with hands-on activities. The show is produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. The executive producer is John Hoban. We want to hear from you, the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Time for All Things Considered at 3 o'clock.